We have been dealing with the history of the Reformation of the 16th century. I raised the question at the outset of why a church should ever need to be reformed, and gave a little analysis of factors which it appeared to me bore upon the phenomenon of degeneration and of continual renewal. Then went on to consider the specific situation in the 16th century, the abuses which needed to be corrected, and the various attempts made at reform. Luther himself said that what differentiated him from previous reformers was this, that they centered on the life and he on the teaching. That is to say that they criticized only moral abuses, which of course he criticized. But he struck at some of the concepts of the Catholic Church, and above all else at the belief that man can manipulate God, that man by his good works can gain credits and present a claim upon God. At this he struck. And this actually proved to be more potent than the criticism of particular moral abuses. But did it prove to be more potent because people really understood what he was saying? Or was there a confluence of particular forces, complex in character, but not altogether focused around his emphasis? Was it that now, at last, the objection to moral abuses, financial abuses, political abuses, all came to a head in such fashion that there was a convulsion? Of course, it's difficult to say, but this is obvious that Luther did spark the conflagration, and that he did so as the result of a personal problem. He did not start out to reform the church. In fact, he had nothing more in mind than to reform theological education by building it around the Bible instead of the study of the scholastics. He did not intend what happened. From his point of view, it was fortuitous or providential, as you will. But it did come out of the intensity of his personal conviction. We turn, therefore, to biography, examined the nature of his sense of alienation from God, and the resolution which he found through the revelation of God's grace and the mediation of God's grace in and through Christ. This, however, incidentally, for Luther himself, was not a static discovery. He was having to wrestle with his alienation for all of his life. Constantly he was beset by the powers of darkness, losing his confidence in God or in Christ, but he always found somewhere to lay hold. If Christ seemed to have forsaken him, he would say, I go back to the first commandment, I am the Lord thy God, thy God. That means that God made a promise and I'll hold him to it. He would never let go. And if God seemed to be the all-terrible, the God of cataclysms, of disregard for human life, the God of wrath and disaster, then he would turn to the mercy of God in Christ. But he always found somewhere to lay hold. Here then is a man of intense religious concern, of profound insights, though that suggests that he got them, disclosures which were rather given to him. This he proclaimed. Because he was a preacher, he was concerned for his parishioners, and when they were thinking to cut down purgatory by securing indulgences through having the Pope transfer to them the unused credits of the saints, he came out with a blast. And his 95 theses, in which he set forth these views, led him on to more and more radical affirmations. When the Pope refused to recognize what he had said, which appeared to him to be simply the gospel, then he declared that the Pope was wrong. And the controversy moved from indulgences, which soon came almost to be forgotten, to such questions as papal infallibility, and moved on then into the political sphere as to the degree of jurisdiction which the Church has any right to have over the political and over society. For the Catholic Church had claimed that because only the priest can perform the sacraments, and only through the sacraments is there salvation, that therefore the simplest priest is superior to any king or emperor, And the church may undertake to be the directive agency even in the political sphere. Luther was to deny this, saying that every Christian is a priest. He undercut the whole theory of Catholic sacramentalism and sacerdotalism. Sacramentalism in the sense that the sacraments as such, and even independently of the faith of the believer, can affect salvation, and that they can be administered only by those who stand in a line of textual succession going back to the very beginnings. Whereas Luther, who did not despise this succession, said that it is not absolutely necessary, and in an emergency, any congregation might choose one of its members to perform the sacraments. Such an affirmation destroyed the presuppositions for the entire ecclesiastical and social structure. There was very genuine radicalism here. The Pope, after much dallying, largely for political reasons, finally gave Luther 60 days in which to recant. But the bull which gave this verdict, though issued in June, did not reach him until October, because there was so much opposition in Germany, even on the part of bishops, to this kind of treatment of Luther. He spent the interim time bringing out a number of tracts in which he elaborated his views, the address to the German nobility, which gave his picture of the church, of society, dealt with the externals of the church largely, which he would reduce to apostolic simplicity, if not extreme poverty. And then the Babylonian captivity, in which he dealt with the whole sacramental structure and the freedom of the Christian man, where he deals with ethics, saying that the Christian man is of all men the most free, free from ceremonialism, free from dependence on his own good works to save him, but bound by love to his neighbor. For the Christian is obligated to be a Christ to his neighbor. And even as Christ took to himself the sins of others, so the Christian must assume the guilt and the responsibility of the wrongs which his loved ones have committed. Then came the fall of the year 1520. The bull finally reached Luther. He came out with a blast against it. He had 60 days now in which to make his recantation. What should be done with him was the question which confronted those who would have to make the ultimate decision. Frederick the Wise rather wondered. He had always said he didn't understand theology. He was not passing any opinion on what Luther said, but he was determined that he should have a fair hearing. He had no mind to back a heretic, but was he a heretic? Besides, all the faculty of the University of Wittenberg backed him up. And Frederick, who was very proud of his university, couldn't think that all of his professors might be wrong. It would be easier to suppose that the Pope might be wrong. Erasmus was by this time almost the arbiter of Europe. People were referring questions to him of all kinds and sorts, and Frederick wanted his opinion. Now it so happened that after Charles of Spain, who had been elected emperor, was crowned at Aachen, he went to Cologne, and there was a little gathering of some of the leaders of the empire, including the senior member of the Electoral College, Frederick the Wise. And Charles had a conference with Frederick. Well, now Frederick had a conference with Erasmus. He called him in. He said, "What sins has Luther committed?" And Erasmus said, "Two. He has struck at the bellies of the monks and the tiara of the Pope." And Frederick laughed, went out and saw the emperor, and got from him a promise that Luther would not be condemned unverhört, in auditus, without a hearing. Now, the empire was to meet in the beginning of the next year at its first diet since Charles had been elected. Now that he was Holy Roman Emperor, he had a loose authority over all of the estates of Germany, but he couldn't act without the representatives of the various principalities. He would be meeting with them, and the gathering was set for the city of Worms on the Rhine. The emperor agreed that Luther should have a hearing before the diet. Incidentally, that suggestion apparently emanated, first of all, from the University of Wittenberg. Well, when the 60 days were up, Luther, instead of submitting, burned the Pope's bull and the canon law. "Oh, now," said Erasmus, "that's a bit thick." And the emperor was shocked by it. But Frederick the Wise actually apologized for Luther. The senior member of the Electoral College apologizing for a man who had burned a papal bull in the canon law. What Frederick said was, "They have already burned his books at Cologne and Mainz before he has been officially condemned by the Church of the Empire. So this is just an act of retaliation." Now, of course, I admit that he shouldn't have done this, but still, he had a high degree of provocation. Of course, Detroit should not have been burned down, but the whole class that did it has suffered extreme provocation. That's about what he was saying. But the emperor rescinded his agreement that Luther should come to the Diet of Worms. The Diet met, and old Frederick the Wise came riding in on the 6th of January, Epiphany, like one of the three kings. Es war am Dreikönigentag, on the day of the three kings. He was upset when he found Luther wasn't coming to the Diet. Now, at the Diet, there were a number of parties, and the proceedings went far from smoothly. There was the extreme papalist party, which thought to settle the whole affair by getting Luther burned in a hurry. And the man who was pushing this on the papal side was Jerome Aleander, an Italian, a great scholar, an old friend of Erasmus. They'd roomed together for nearly a year in Venice, and Erasmus had secured for him a teaching post at the University of Paris. He was learned in Greek and, of course, Latin, but also in Semitic languages. No mean scholar. He'd been rather loose in his personal behavior, but then most of the leaders of the church had. But he was beginning to be something of an ascetic and ended up in the spirit of the Counter-Reformation. And his thought now was to deal severely with heretics. In January, the Pope had issued or signed a bull of excommunication. You see, the bull of June of the previous year had merely given him 60 days in which to recant. At the end of that time, he would automatically be excommunicated. However, the public didn't know when the 60 days started, because they began on the day when the bull was delivered. Therefore, another bull was necessary to say, "Time's up," and the excommunication goes into effect. And this the Pope did in January and told the emperor that he had done so. But a bull of excommunication didn't actually take effect until it was published. Copies had to be sent to the bishops. They would then have the ringing of bells and the throwing of lighted tapers to the floor, and they would declare that no priest was to receive this heretic to communion. Only when this liturgy had been fulfilled was a man strictly out of communion, excommunicated. Aleander urged the Pope to send him 40 copies of the bull, which he could distribute now to the bishops. Only one copy came. And when Aleander looked at it, he found that it excommunicated not only Luther, but Billy Ball Pirkheimer from Nuremberg, and Lazarus Spengler from Nuremberg, and Ulrich von Hutten. Well, now, Billy Ball Pirkheimer was a very distinguished humanist, and Lazarus Spengler was the town councillor of Nuremberg. And what was the point of stirring up all the humanists? And as for Ulrich von Hutten was a fiery German nationalist who wanted to unify Germany by throwing the church out of Germany. He had not gained any hearing at that point from the emperor, but he did gain support from Franz von Sickingen. Franz von Sickingen was the leader of the old knightly class, who were on the point of being displaced by gunpowder, but still had a military value. He had at his disposal a large mercenary force. He used them, he said, to promote justice, but he was continually hunting up cases of injustice because he had to employ his men. And he would hire out either to the emperor or to the king of France, according to whichever offered the most lucrative solution. In other words, he was what you would call in Italy a condottiere, a leader of a band of mercenaries. He had a castle at the Ebenburg up above the Rhine, and on an earlier occasion, he had blocked traffic up the Rhine at the point of Worms and almost starved the city. Consequently, he had real military power. And the emperor had no troops at the Diet of Worms. Well, now Houghton had joined up with him, had read him Luther's writings, Singingen couldn't read, and he now decided that he would be the vindicator of the gospel. So Houghton and Singingen were perched up on the hill and quite in a position to swoop down on Worms. And Houghton was named in the bull. Oh, no, said Aleander, sent the bull straight back to Rome, and said, send me another one, mentioning only Luther. Well, now it took at least 3 weeks to get word back from Rome. At least that. And the Pope at Rome dallied, until it began to appear that the greatest support for Luther was coming from the papacy. Aleander frankly suggested that he was being led down. In the meantime, he said, my life is hardly safe in Germany. And if Houghton is excommunicated, I have reason to fear assassination. Houghton was simply sending in pamphlets of a blood-curdling character, inciting the Germans to revolutionary activity. And these little Flugschriften, they were called, pamphlets, were beginning to circulate around Worms while the Diet was going on. And Aleander was positively frightened. Now, there were those who wished to avoid the extremes of Houghton on the one hand and his war against the papacy, and Aleander on the other hand and his desire to extinguish Luther. There were the moderates, and they were of different varieties. Old Frederick the Wise was a moderate. He had a strong German feeling. He didn't understand theology, but as I said, he was insistent that Luther should be fairly treated. But in a way, he had gotten one point from Luther. To be fairly treated meant to be convicted of heresy out of the scriptures. Well, that meant departing from the whole tradition of the church. So even if old Frederick didn't fully grasp what was meant by justification by faith, or what was wrong with indulgences, incidentally, he supported the University of Wittenberg out of indulgences. And when Luther attacked them, he was really striking at the income of the institution from which he received his own support. Well, old Frederick didn't quite understand all that. But that one must be convicted out of scripture, that stuck with him. Then there were the Erasmians. Erasmian wasn't there. Erasmus wasn't. But he sent in a memorandum proposing that Luther's case be referred to three laymen. King of France, King of England, the King of Hungary. Not churchmen at all. So here we have the extreme papalist party, the extreme revolutionary anti-papal party, and the moderates, old Frederick, who's determined that this is going to be fair, and the Erasmian party, who want to work out, if possible, some kind of a compromise. For Erasmus insisted all along that Luther was not a heretic. Well, Aleander couldn't get the bull that he wanted. Delay, delay, delay. It didn't come until April, and the Diet had begun back in January. Aleander, therefore, found himself compelled to go before the Diet and prove that Luther was a heretic. Well, that practically meant treating the Diet as if it were an ecclesiastical council. Secular tribunals were not supposed to determine what was heresy. And the Diet of Worms, of course, had a lot of bishops in it, but it had also a great many laymen. He was treating a secular assembly as if it were an ecclesiastical court. And it's very interesting that Hefele, in his Konkiliengeschichte, his History of the Church Councils, from the Lateran Council, the Fifth Lateran of 1512, down to the Council of Regensburg in 1541, lists as church councils the diets of the German Empire, because actually they were dealing with ecclesiastical and even doctrinal matters. So Aleander, by his inability or unwillingness to produce the bull, was turning the Diet of Worms into an ecclesiastical council. It was far from what he wanted to do. So then he had to come in and prove that Luther was a heretic. And he did a pretty good job. Because since the bull of June 1520, the bull Exsurge, Luther had come out with all these other pamphlets. And Aleander knew them very well. And he was able to recite whole passages. But people at the Diet said to him, "But why should we condemn Luther, the Pope hasn't?" "Why? The church hasn't condemned him." Because, you see, the bull actually had not been published. It was perfectly evident that the Diet was not going to condemn Luther unless they heard him themselves. So the invitation had to be renewed. And the emperor wrote to Luther saying, "Dearly beloved son..." "Oh, my God, no," said Aleander. "You mustn't call him that." But the emperor invited his dearly fili, his most beloved son, to come and answer for himself at the Diet. Well then, the Erasmian party had an idea. The emperor's confessor, Lapion by name, was commissioned to carry it out. Namely, keep Luther from getting to the Diet. Intercept him. Persuade him to come up to Sickingen and Houten. And have a little committee up there and work the thing out and arrive at some kind of a compromise solution and then present that to the Diet. Well, Glapion had the courage, and you must give him credit for that, the emperor's confessor, to go up to Sickingen and Houten in person. And after all of their blood-curdling tracts, he might have suspected they'd cut his throat. But he pointed out to them how disastrous it would be if the church were rent and civil war perhaps came in Germany. Of course, that of itself wouldn't bother Houghton too much. He rather wanted a war. But Glapion conceded a good deal more than the Church of Rome actually would ever have allowed. And Houghton was really taken in by it and agreed that they should try to get Luther and see if they couldn't arrive at an understanding. They sent a man to intercept him on the way to Worms. The man was Martin Bucer. He was an escaped Dominican monk who had taken refuge up there. Later on, he became the great reformer of Strasbourg. And later, after his exile, he was in England and wrote a whole plan for the English Reformation. But right now, you could just call him a renegade monk. They commissioned him to go down and intercept Luther. Well, Luther was already on his way to the Diet, and Bucer found him. And Luther said, "If the emperor commands me, God commands me." Now, some people have said that means that Luther treated the emperor as if he were God and that he completely sold out to the state. That wasn't Luther's point. His point was that he had respect for authority. He would not defy authority flagrantly. If the emperor summoned him, he felt his responsibility to appear and to give an answer. "If there are in Worms as many devils as there are tiles on the roofs, I will go in and walk into Behemoth's mouth and confess Christ." Bucer returned and reported, and Houghton said, "Yes, that's it. There's the difference. He considers only the things of God." Luther came to the Diet. He was brought in late one afternoon when there was not a full attendance. The emperor was there, presiding. A very young man, you know, only about 20 as I recall. One thinks of him as a majestic old figure looking like God the Father Almighty in Renaissance paintings. But he was really only a lad presiding over the Diet. The examiner confronted Luther with a big pile of his books and asked him whether they were all his. Luther's lawyer called out, "Make them read the titles, in titolento libri." Let them read the titles. They were read off, and the examiner said, "Are they all yours?" Now that gave Luther a chance to resolve the difficulty by repudiating, perchance, the tract on the sacraments. For there was a strong feeling that if only he'd yield on that, they could negotiate on the other points. After all, they could call off the indulgence racket even if they didn't change the theory. They read the titles. Luther said, "I'm amazed you've collected so many. They're all mine. I've written some more." "Very well," said the examiner. "Do you or do you not stand behind everything you have written in these books?" That gave him another chance. He might have said, "Yes, I wrote the Babylonian captivity, but I'm not prepared to stand by all of it." Luther said, "Give me time to think it over." "But," said the examiner, "you're a professor. You ought to be able to answer right away, and you knew what you came for. You're expected to make a defense." "Nevertheless, the emperor graciously allows you until tomorrow." Why did Luther hesitate? They said he spoke in a low and faltering voice. He indicates that he was overwhelmed by his sense of responsibility. He had a wide following now. Men looked to him as the exponent of evangelical truth. Had he perhaps said some things that he shouldn't stand by? He wanted to think it over. They gave him until the next day. He returned, and the diet was now full. His voice was ringing. They gave him again the chance to repudiate his books. They asked him again whether he stood by all of it. He said, "My works divide into three classes." That was skillful, because that gave him a chance to make a speech. Aleander's tactic was to get him simply to say yes or no to the whole thing. First, he said, "There are those passages in my works which deal with Christian piety, and I couldn't go back on that without renouncing all of the gospel." It was perfectly true. Erasmus, to the very end, said, "There are some very Christian things in Luther's works." And the extreme Catholic said to him, "What?" He said, "The Magnificat and the 14 of Consolation." There are two works of Luther. As a matter of fact, if he hadn't been judged a heretic, they would probably have become classics of Catholic piety. He said, "I can't go back on everything I've said without renouncing Christianity itself, and the Pope wouldn't want me to do that. And then there's what I've said about the grievances of this German nation, and the Germans would not want me to go back on that." And most of the people in the diet were Germans. That, too, would meet with a hearty response. Finally, he said, "There are passages in which I have spoken rather too hotly against my opponents. I know it. I'm not a saint, but I'm not being judged on my life, but upon my teaching. And if I were to take this back, it would give undue occasion to my enemies to rejoice." And then he began to give a little homily to the emperor on how to run the empire. After the manner of King David and the noble kings of Israel. Well, the examiner thought this was just a little overdoing it. He broke in and said, "Now look here, Martin. Who are you to set yourself up in this fashion? Are you alone wise? Tu solus sapis, are you alone wise? Who are you to go against the teaching that has been given to us by Christ, expounded by the apostles, declared by the church councils, confirmed by the popes, and given us to believe? Who are you? Of course you say there's some truth in your teaching. Certainly there is. There is in the works of all the heretics. That's what makes them more so insidious. Give us an answer then, without teeth. Do you or do you not repudiate your teaching?" "Very well," said Luther, "I will give you an answer without teeth and without horns. Unless I am convinced by reason and by scripture, I do not accept the authority of popes and councils. They can err and they have erred. Unless I am so convinced, I will not recant. God help me, amen." He had said this in German. They said to him, "Now repeat it in Latin." One man called out, "If you can't do it, doctor, you've said enough." Did he conclude with the famous words, "Ich stehe ich, here I stand"? They are not in any of the notes. that were taken on the occasion, but they were in print within a month. And if you know how long it takes to get anything printed, you realize that they must have been in immediate circulation. The possibility has occurred to me that note takers may have been so overpowered that they stopped taking notes. One reviewer said, "Oh, that's a silly suggestion." We know on one occasion, however, quite definitely, that Luther got so animated that Rohrer, one of his note takers, just gave up on it. So it is conceivable that he said the words and the note takers were like this. But at any rate, they were very speedily in circulation, and they epitomize what he did, even if he did not use the very words on that occasion. He was taken out from the diet, and then there was an interview with the committee. He had refused to give in any respect before the diet. Perhaps a committee could break him down. It was presided over by Richard von Greifenklau, the Archbishop of Trier. There had been an earlier proposal that he might head a commission of investigation. Frederick the Wise rather liked the idea, and now he headed this committee. There were several Catholics on it, naturally, and there were some of the Erasmian party. And the hope now was that they could persuade him to yield on enough so that the question could become negotiable. And they said to him, "Can't you compromise on something? If you don't, there will be Zwietracht, Krieg und Aufruhr, war, insurrection, rebellion." And, of course, in the end, there was. Luther's reply was essentially this. You can compromise about lands and say, you take this one, I take that one. You can't dicker about the truth. You can't say that you do believe what you don't believe, or that you don't believe what you do believe. This isn't the area for compromise. And one man said to him, "Do you realize that if you go under, Melanchthon will go under too?" And Luther broke into tears. But still, he wouldn't budge. The word was taken back to the diet. There was a meeting of the electors, and it appeared that all of them were prepared to vote against Luther, which would include Frederick the Wise. But 2 days later, when they actually came to account, Frederick refused to condemn him. What did Frederick go through in those 2 days? We don't know, but it seems that he was on the point of wavering and then came into the clear. The emperor came before the diet and read his own personal statement, in which he said that he was descended from a long line of Catholic sovereigns, that he would rather lose his lands than have them tainted with heresy. And he meant it. He also was a man of conviction. He'd rather not be the king of Spain or the emperor if the Christian faith, as he conceded, was to go under. It was conviction against conviction. He therefore gave Luther 40 days in which to go back home, because he'd been given a safe conduct and the emperor intended to respect it. He would not go back on it the way they had gone back on the safe conduct given to John Huss. Luther should have 40 days, but after that, anybody could capture him and turn him over to the authorities and would be reimbursed for any expense involved. And of course that meant that Luther would go to the stake. Luther slipped away from the diet. The outcome was inevitable, and he didn't wait for the reading of that document by the emperor. When he was going through the Black Forest, he was attacked by a group of horsemen. Luther's companions fled. They didn't know that it was a ruse, but he did. For Frederick had called in his chaplain, Spalatin, and said, "Now look here, hide Luther and don't tell me where he is. I want to be able to say that I don't know." Luther was taken to the Wartburg, an old castle. Incidentally, the communists in East Germany are having a big celebration over the 1,000th year of the Wartburg. Somebody sent me the Wartburg stamp and said, are they going Lutheran? I said, "Well, hardly. You must remember that the Wartburg is famous for the Meistersinger and Walter von der Vogelheide, and it goes way back of Luther." Of course, they may not object to a little extra prestige that Luther might have given it, but at any rate, it's a German antiquity, and it can be celebrated just as the Turks can celebrate Hagia Sophia because it's a great building and not because it's a Christian church. Well, there he was hidden in that great castle by himself except for a custodian. And then a wave of depression came over him. In the hours of darkness when the bats were wheeling about inside his room, and he began to say to himself, "Tu sola sapis, bist du allein klug? Are you alone wise? Can it be that all the diet, all the leaders of the church, all of the empire which have condemned me are wrong? And I only am right?" He tells us in the morning that he threw open the shutters and looked at the far hillside, where smoke was rising from the pits of the charcoal burners. And a gust of wind came, and it was dissipated. Even so were my doubts dispelled. And he went to work. And the work was the translation of the New Testament. His greatest work, his most influential work. For I'm beginning to think that this was what popularized the Reformation. By and by, some of those who had supported him fell away. The humanists began to split, and some with and some against. The German nationalists collapsed. And yet, he came to have a wide following. And I suspect that no factor was greater than that he had translated the New Testament into magnificent German, and that it could be disseminated by the printing press and read to those who couldn't read. He was at the Wartburg a year, but in half of that time he had translated the whole of the New Testament. He worked from the Vulgate, of course, but also from the Greek text of Erasmus, which had appeared from the edition of 1519. He had old German translations before him, and there were a good many. Luther wasn't the first to translate the scriptures into German. There were 17 pre-Lutheran German editions, and the Zeiner Bibel and the Mainz Bibel are magnificent volumes, and all in German before Luther. His distinction is not that he was the first to make a translation, but what a translation he made. It was so rich, so powerful. One critic has taken Luther's translation of the Sermon on the Mount and laid it side by side with the earlier ones and said, "See, what's so good about his? Why, the words are almost the same." Well, they've almost got to be when you've got the same thing to translate as far as that goes. "Ah, but the way he puts them together and the little nuances, the shades, the word order, the rhythm, the sheer majesty in the music of it. This is eine Kunstwerke. This is a work of art as well as a work of profound religion." The Old Testament came later. It was only the New, which he did in this period. But see how he translates the New. Take that passage which in the King James Version reads, it's in Luke 22:7, I think, "With desire have I desired to eat with you this Passover. Now, with desire, have I desired, is not English. This repetition of the words is not Greek. It's a Semitic idiom which came into the New Testament itself, and in the Greek it is epithymia, epithymesa, with desire have I desired. In all the Latin translations, it was desideravi, desiderio, desideravi. And in the old German, it was mit begehr, hab ich begehrt. But Luther, wie herzlich hab ich begehrt, mit euch das Passahlamm zu essen. Wie herzlich hab ich begehrt. Ach. The Revised Standard Version has how from my heart have I desired, or something of the kind, is taken Luther and dropped the old King James. Now that's the way he translates. It's vibrant, it's powerful. It comes out of the depth of experience. Later when he comes to the Old Testament, save me, O God, from secret sins, he translates it, von unbekannten Sünden, unrecognized sins, because he so often insists that man doesn't admit he's a sinner until he's confronted by an accusation. Otherwise, like Jonah, he goes blithely to sleep in the hold of the ship. Save me, O God, from unrecognized, unbekannten Sünden. That's the way he translated. The work was published in September of 1522 and accompanied by some woodcuts, which were a trifle regrettable. Incidentally, here's a curious thing. The pre-Lutheran German Bibles are copiously illustrated with woodcuts from the Old Testament and the Apocalypse. But for the Pauline epistles and the Gospels, they have only initial letters. And that tradition persists until the 1560s, when Veit Dietrich put out an epitome of Luther's Bible with illustrations for the whole of the life of Christ. I've been speculating and reading on the history of art to see if I can find a reason for that. I don't know quite what it was, but there it is. But Revelation was illustrated all the way through. And in the September Bible, they call it, the September Bible of the New Testament of Luther, in the Apocalypse, and the scarlet woman sitting on the seven hills is wearing the papal tiara. And the dragon in the temple also has the papal tiara. And the great abyss that comes up out of the deep he's a big bull, but he's got a sort of a fold of skin on the back here, which looks exactly like a monk's cowl. And as for Babylon, you can see very plainly the Belvedere, in other words, and various other buildings in Rome. So Babylon is quite identifiable as Rome, and the scarlet woman is the Pope, and the dragon in the temple is the Pope, and the great monster from the abyss represents monasticism. Well, Frederick the Wise said, now come here. I don't wish any unnecessary provocation. So in the next edition, they chopped off the papal tiara down to one layer. You see, with a woodcut, you can't expand, but you can contract by chiseling off some of it. So they chopped off two layers from this cake and got the papal tiara down, just a plain ordinary crown. And they did that on the tiara, on the woman and on the devil. But they forgot to do anything to the great beast with the monk's cowl. And the curious thing is that a Catholic opponent of Luther put out another New Testament to counter his, and purchased the woodcuts from Luther's publisher and put them in without noticing what he got. He didn't have the tiara, but he had the monk, and he had Rome with the Belvedere and so on. Well, after Frederick the Wise was dead, they did the woodcuts over again, put the tiara back on. And I don't know quite how long these persisted in Luther Bibles. But this illustrates one other point, and I'll have to stop with that. Namely, that along with the New Testament, there began a great flood of publications. There were more pamphlets published in the four years in Germany, I think from 22 to 26, than in any other period of German history. To be sure, there were newspapers later on, but just Flugschriften, and practically all of them have to do with the Reformation. And the other point is that the Reformation, for the first time, makes extensive use of the cartoon, the polemical woodcut. And then the Catholics take it up, too, and you get cartoon against cartoon. There's a whole extensive publication of this material by Geisberg, Max Geisberg. Einblatt Holzschnitten der Reformationszeit. One sheet woodcuts. They're as big as this, you know. At least they are in his republication of it. Mostly Protestant against the Catholic Church and some on the other side. So now began a big campaign of pamphleteering. Some of it pretty rough. Tracts of all kinds, illustrations, so that Germany came to be in a ferment, and the ideas of the Reformation, oversimplified naturally, without Luther's profound undertones and overtones, simplified and often crude, were nevertheless widely disseminated among the people. The Reformation was becoming a movement which no emperor could suppress. But at the same time, rifts began within the church in Wittenberg. And as the Reformation took on a national character, and pretty soon a European character, varieties began to emerge, and the solidarity which Luther had supposed would issue from the expounding of the Word of God ended rather in widespread diversity and the beginnings of a religious pluralism. And all of that set up again, in acute fashion, the problem of religious liberty. Well, I'll have to leave it here for today.